Welcome to the Amazing Nerd Show, now resurrecting an animal-based hero. Strap in, folks, the nerds have arrived, bringing you the ultimate nerd podcast. Nerds, the worlds of gaming, horror, TV, and film, have collided right here. This will be your finest hour.
Hey, this is Christian.
Hey, this is David.
And this is the Amazing Nerd Show.
All right, on this week's podcast, we're breaking down all the latest news and rumors in nerddom, and we also have a film review for Late Night with the Devil.
And we're talking AEW's Big Business. All right, but before we move on, make sure to subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform.
And while you're at it, give us a 5-star review and DM us a screenshot. Not only will we read it on the show, but we'll send you some Amazing Nerd Show swag.
Also, if you'd like to further support the Amazing Nerd Show, make sure to check out our Patreon in the show notes. Or go to patreon.com/AmazingNerdShow. But with that said, let's get into the news.
Every week we collect the biggest headlines and rumors of nerddom. We're not mild-mannered reporters, we're mere podcasters with opinions.
Warning, potential spoilers for upcoming shows and movies ahead. Check timestamps to avoid spoilers. You have been warned.
Well, to start things off this week, we have an update on the sequel to Shang-Chi with a surprise character set to make an appearance.
On X, Daniel Richmond noted that his sources claim, Shang-Chi 2 will begin filming in 2025, with Destin Daniel Cretton still on to, helm the film. As far as the plot goes, Richmond gave, little nuggets of information here by saying the story will involve, some time travel elements and introduce us to the immortal Iron Fist. This Iron Fist is also said to be featured in the Eyes of Wakanda animated series that is still in the works.
So the fact that they're talking about time travel makes me believe that this isn't going to be the Iron Fist that we know already from the Netflix series, which isn't a bad thing. So I'm assuming we're going to meet an Iron Fist perhaps from the past, which once again, I'm totally fine with. Shang-Chi and Iron Fist, the lore kind of tie into each other. So this makes sense. And maybe this will be a great way to spit out, a real Iron Fist story in the near future. One that isn't the shitty Netflix version.
I wonder if, they'll have Shang-Chi dealing with the TVA if they're going to be doing, time travel. But
at this point, who the hell knows? I mean, I'm still waiting for follow-up to the end credits scene of Shang-Chi, which was that happened mm-hmm. 3 years ago?
Yeah.
So I just kind of assumed we'd get more info in Marvel's since, Captain Marvel was part of that scene. But I guess that wasn't the case. I mean, at this point, every time I think the MCU is going to zig, they zag. So I don't know, man.
Well, speaking of zagging.
Well, yeah. So speaking of zagging, it looks like the MCU is going to trim some fat when it comes to their upcoming film slate.
Another story from Daniel Richmond claims that Marvel Studios is looking to, take less risks with its projects after diminishing returns over the last phase. Apparently, Eternals 2 has been in the works, but is now on hold, along with sequels for Ant-Man and Captain Marvel, both now expected not to even happen at all, especially after their box office flops. It's believed, though, that Feige is still pushing for an Eternals 2 to be made, while Bob Iger believes it's just destined to fail.
I'm going to have to agree with Bob Iger here. I mean, no one wants this movie. Someone needs to, shake some sense into Kevin Feige at this point. I mean,
he must have some grand plan for, the Titans and everything.
I mean, is there a way to tell that story, in other films, perhaps?
It would work better as a series.
Now, I will say I am disappointed that we're not going to get another sequel to Captain Marvel. At least that's what it looks like right now. But, I mean... But at the same time, we could also see Carol's story play out in other films, maybe a Miss Marvel movie. And the same kind of goes with Ant-Man, right? I'm sure he's going to be involved in Secret Wars or the next Avengers film.
Yeah, I don't think we need an Ant-Man 4. I didn't even realize we were going to be getting to a 3, let alone a 4.
Well, after I saw Ant-Man 3, I didn't think we really needed that film either. So, I agree 100%. I love the character, don't get me wrong, but he doesn't need his own film. I'd rather have Marvel focus on new quality content, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And if, you know, trimming the fat is how we get there, then so be it. Well, up next, we've got a shocker of a story. With X-Men 97 only a week away, Marvel has parted ways with the show's creator.
THR reports that creator and executive producer Bu DeMaio, who has writing credits as well for the entirety of seasons 1 and 2 of the X-Men 97 series, has been let go by Disney. Bu DeMaio was said to already be working on a season 3 for the X-Men 97 series when, you know, receiving this news. DeMaio has previously worked on Moon Knight and the reboot of Blade. No word on why this has happened has dropped just yet, but DeMaio, who was set for press events, has backed out of all of those and has gone as far to delete his Instagram as well. His work on the second season is reportedly done, but who knows if they will need someone for, you know, rewrites and, you know, such going forward.
Yeah, and strangely, he's already been doing press for X-Men 97.
Yeah.
So as recent as like just a couple weeks ago. But I mean, I don't know, like right away, this news is a little discouraging. I was worried that it was an indicator of the show's quality. Now, from the first reactions to the series, like people have seen a couple episodes at this point, that doesn't seem to be the case at all. And a producer actually came out today, I believe, and from the way they stated it, it sounds like it might have been more of like creative differences, because he was working on season 2 and planning season 3. So maybe they just didn't agree with the direction that the series was going in, but that's just pure speculation on my part. But with all that being said, I'm really looking forward to the series. I mean, they released a clip, I believe yesterday, with the X-Men battling against some Sentinels, and it looked fucking amazing. So, you know, if you're interested in hearing about the series, make sure you go ahead and check us out next week, because we'll have a breakdown for the first 2 episodes. Well, lastly, on the Marvel front, we've got an update on the upcoming WandaVision spinoff series starring Agatha Harkness.
Disney has revealed new promotional material for the upcoming series following WandaVision star Catherine Hahn as Agatha Harkness. And it features what is now the 3rd name change for the series, but a simple one nonetheless, as it's gone from Agatha Darkhold Diaries to now just being called Agatha. The series is still set to come out this fall.
I don't know, man. Like, at this point, do you think this is just a big rib?
The Agatha series?
No, not the series, but the name changing. Like, this is like the 4th or 5th name change, right?
I don't know. Maybe Vince got hired over at, you know, Marvel and he's just shortening everything.
I doubt that. Or Kevin Feige will be looking for a new job next.
Uh-huh.
Well, I guess I lied. We have one last Marvel story, kind of. Venom 3 gets a new title along with a new release date.
Columbia Pictures has announced that Venom 3 will now be called Venom The Last Dance, with it also moving slightly up in the pipeline, switching from its November 8th release date to now October 25th. With a title like that, though, it's speculated that this could be Tom Hardy's final performance as Eddie Brock in the Sony Spider film.
Fingers crossed. All right, well, moving on to the DCU. This week, we got some disappointing news for the sequel to The Batman.
Warner Brothers Pictures announced the sad news that The Batman Part 2 has been delayed an entire year now, going from October 3rd, 2025 to October 2nd, 2026. The Penguin series set in the same continuity, however, has no delays on it just yet, so we're still expecting it to come out later this year.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, this is sad news. But at the same time, I mean, it was just a couple months ago that Matt Reeves was like talking about what he's doing with the script for the movie. I mean, it was right then and there that I knew this movie was not coming out in 2025. I mean, if he's still writing the fucking script, there's no way.
I could have hope, can't I? Damn it.
Nope, not here, Christian. This is the podcast where hope goes to die. I'm just kidding, but sticking with the DCU, it looks like we have some new details on the second season of Peacemaker.
Star of the hit series Peacemaker, Jennifer Holland, who plays Amelia Harcourt, revealed that Peacemaker season 2 would begin filming in the summer. But James Gunn this week also did some clarifications for Peacemaker, as he went on X to explain to fans how the first season is partially out of canon due to, you know, events that tie into the old continuity, but season 2 will be, you know, fully DCU canon, as it is now set to come out after Superman, but also before the Waller solo series as well.
Yeah, I mean, this makes sense. I mean, he's already said the same thing about, you know, his Suicide Squad movie, so I didn't really expect anything different when it came to the first season of Peacemaker. I'm sure, like, certain events probably actually happened, but you know, they're going to just kind of pretend other events that, you know, involve the DCEU, you know, didn't actually take place. And I think with Peacemaker, that's pretty easy to do.
I think all that matters is just that his hero's journey is intact, and that's
right.
Yeah, you know, everything else is unnecessary.
Yeah, I think his personal story still works regardless of the continuity. So
we also learned from THR this week that DC Films is planning a Teen Titans film. This was recently teased by Gunn himself when he claimed the rumor may be true online. But according to THR, Anna Noguera, who's been working with Gunn on the Supergirl Woman of Tomorrow film, will be on to write the live-action Teen Titans film. It's believed at this time that Dick Grayson and other Bat family members will be featured in the Brave and the Bold Batman film for the DCU, but it's unknown what other members the Titans might have. The team has been, you know, seen with multiple variations over the years, having started with Kid Flash and Aqualad. But of course, I'd love to see, you know, the revamped team of Starfire, Raven, Beast Boy, and, you know, Cyborg, along with Robin, together on screen in the DCU. But I do also know that, you know, Gunn is a, you know, old school fucking DC fan, so I wouldn't be too surprised if we get a different type of team, especially since we've just seen a, you know, live action TV show featuring, you know, all these characters as well. But I grew up with the, you know, the cartoon, so I love that cartoon so fucking much, and I would love to see any type of live action adaptation of some of the storylines that they did in that, you know, come to light.
All right, let's head to Galaxy Far, Far Away. It looks like we have some casting news for the upcoming Rey-led Star Wars film.
Apparently, casting for the Daisy Ridley-led Star Wars film has begun, according to Daniel Richmond sources. It's believed that the studio is looking for two new leads for Rey to, you know, mentor over, as this has been 15 years after the Rise of Skywalker. It's also been said that Angela Bassett has spoken with Lucasfilm for a role in Star Wars, and Richmond sources believe that she could be playing the villain. This film is still looking at a May 22nd, 2026 release.
Angela Bassett as a Star Wars villain sounds absolutely amazing. I mean, make this happen, please. I mean, if you can get Angela Bassett in your film, you get her in your film no matter what the role is. But her as, like, you know, a villain, come on. Who doesn't want to see that?
Even like as a dark force user, that's crazy to think. I can't imagine her in that position.
She would be terrifying. Yes, I hope this is true, you know, and it actually happens. Well, staying with Star Wars, it looks like a previously shelved Star Wars project is reportedly back on track.
Well, after being removed from the calendar back in 2022, somehow Patty Jenkins' Rogue Squadron film has returned. Jenkins, while on the Talking Picture show, revealed that since her third Wonder Woman film was canceled with the relaunch of DC Films, that she is now moving full steam ahead on Star Wars Rogue Squadron, as she is currently writing the script and has actually been contracted with a new deal with Lucasfilm that supposedly was written up right before the strikes last year.
Listen, Patty Jenkins is a talented director, but it's just going to take, I don't know, a little bit or maybe another film of hers to wash the bad taste of Wonder Woman 84 out of my mouth. Because, man, that movie was just the drizzling shits.
And that was one that she wrote. So that's what makes me more,
yes,
you know, nervous about it.
Right. And I thought maybe this was a case of like Kathleen Kennedy and company wanting to just like respectfully cut ties without it looking like they decided to change their mind after seeing the film also. But it's, I'm not sure timeline wise if that even, you know, tracks. So I hope it's good, you know, and I hope it's real this time around. Because you remember we got that whole, like, trailer of her, like,
mm-hmm, walking out.
Right, on an aircraft carrier, talking, yeah, about how her father was a pilot and everything. You know, it worked on me at that moment. But then there were so many, like, you know, twists and turns with, you know, everything pre-production-wise with the film that it just never felt like it was real. And it still feels that way, unfortunately. Well, lastly, we've got some horror news. After a lot of controversy, a fan favorite actress is making her big return in Scream 7.
Well, with the exit of Jenna Ortega and Melissa Barrera from the Scream franchise, Collider reports that Nev Campbell is back in for Scream 7 as Sydney Prescott. She originally backed away from Scream 6 due to not feeling like she was, you know, being offered the right amount of pay that she deserves for her role. But that most likely isn't an issue anymore for the studio, as they've lost, you know, both their leads. So I'm predicting they probably offered her a decent sum to maybe, you know, help get this franchise back on the right right track. As it was also reported that Kevin Williamson, who wrote on the original Scream, has been set to direct Scream 7.
Well, I hope for her sake she got a big fucking bag, because she absolutely deserves it. Even though I have mixed feelings about another film focused on, you know, Sydney and company, I still want to see some sort of closure when it comes to that storyline. So it did feel a little abrupt last film, you know, not having Sydney involved. And at this point, with all the controversy surrounding the film, I'm sure they probably saw this as the only way to actually get this film made, you know, and have fans support it. I'm still expecting some sort of backlash from, you know, Scream fans, you know, seeing how they let go of Melissa Barrera, because the new core characters, rightfully so, absolutely also have their fans, to the point that I'm kind of surprised that they're not waiting a couple years to let everything, you know, die down a little before moving on with another sequel. Like, honestly, with all the controversy surrounding everything Scream-wise, like, I'm almost wondering if Kevin Williamson was, like, the only, you know, director, and I'm going to use that term loosely because I believe he's only directed one other film, even though, like, he's obviously the original creator along with Wes Craven, you know, of the franchise. But, you know, it is strange that all of a sudden he's stepping into that chair, you know, when he hasn't directed shit, really.
It was interesting because I pulled him up just to see, like, oh, what else has he worked on since? And it was only writing credits, pretty much. And I was just like, oh, okay.
I mean, I think there's, like, you know, Mrs. Tingle or something like that. And that's it. I mean, he's produced and, you know, written lots of different, like, films and series, but he's not really known for being a director. So, like, is it a case of, like, no one else wanting to touch, you know, this film? So, I don't know. We'll see how the film does. You know, casual fans probably won't really give a shit, right? And the last film did so well. I mean, the last two films did so well that it's really, like, rekindled audiences' interest in the franchise. So, you know, we'll see. It should be interesting, though, to see how everything plays out. And finally, in our last story, we have some release news on the Salem's Lot remake.
THR reports this week that Gary Doberman's adaptation of Salem's Lot will not be releasing in theaters, but instead is heading to Max. No release date has been given for this just yet, but it's projected to release sometime in the fourth quarter.
Well, Christian, before we move on, I'd be remiss not to mention that we also got a trailer for The Crow this week.
Until you put the wrong things right. You were given the power of a god. But you're running out of time to save her.
I'm gonna kill them. Every single one of them.
So I want to just briefly talk about this trailer. You know, especially since a couple weeks ago we discussed the first look we got, you know, with the very Jared Leto looking, you know, Joker version of The Crow, if that makes any sense, nipple eye and all. You know, did this trailer, Christian, do a lot to change your mind at all?
It does enough to make me interested in seeing it. But it doesn't change my, you know, perception of how it looks so far as the, you know, Jared Leto look. Like, if anything, it's got the violence that the Suicide Squad didn't get to have. So.
Well, and the original Crow. I mean, the Crow was violent, but not like this violent. Like, this is like John Wick level of violence, to the point where it feels a little too John Wick-like to me. Because, like, the one element that's really missing, and don't get me wrong, like, it has two ingredients that, you know, I want in every film that I watch. Well, not every film, but you know what I mean. You know, bloody violence. But it's missing, like, the goth of it all.
Yes. Because
to me, like, if the 100%. Crow isn't running on some rooftops in the rain, you know, and, like, brooding next to some gargoyles, what the fuck are we doing here? It's such a major, like, aesthetic to that film. Like, it's just a must, and we didn't get any of that in this trailer. Like, it's almost like way well too lit. Like, I, you know, it felt like you could take The Crow out of this film and put John Wick You know, instead, and it would be like the same movie. Like, it would be like, oh, new John Wick film's coming out. I enjoyed all the insane violence that was happening, at, like, to the point where I was like, is this an R-band trailer? Like, what's going on here? You know, it just didn't feel like The Crow to me. It's funny, though, like, it did feel like the trailer went out of the way not to show his mullet. Did you get that vibe?
I wasn't paying attention to the hair, I guess.
And what's the deal with Skarsgård sounding like Pete Davidson? Like, it legitimately sounded like he was channeling, you know, Pete Davidson, which is definitely not what I want out of a Crow film. Like, he's not the spirit of vengeance or whatever the fuck they call him, you know, in the lore. You know, in my eyes.
I don't know if this is like their modern take on noir, but that's what it's missing. It's just missing the scale, like the color scale of a noir film. Because that's what would make this a little bit better. I'm in for the action. I'm there with you there.
Right.
But everything else is just not very much The Crow.
And who knows? Maybe this is just a poorly edited trailer. And like the person who put this together didn't realize what kind of iconic, you know, images they needed to really sell this film. But yeah, no, it definitely wasn't this, you know, what we got here.
Well, do you feel like if the name wasn't attached, if it wasn't The Crow, would you be interested in this?
I think my sticking point is this is supposed to be, you know, the original Crow, Eric. You know, if this was just a different version of The Crow, which they've done plenty of stories with, you know, different people, you know, becoming the embodiment of The Crow. I think if that was the case, then I would be fine with all this, or a little more fine with all this. But the fact that this is supposed to be like a direct remake of that first film, I don't know. I think that's maybe what I'm bumping up against.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, it would have worked to have like the mantle passed down to someone else. It has.
There's plenty of Crow sequels where they do exactly just that. So
don't watch those sequels.
No, they're pretty fucking awful. Hopefully, that's not the case with this film. But I mean, it's like they forgot everything that makes The Crow fucking cool in the first place. They didn't really do great at like capturing the spirit of, you know, why people love that first film. If that makes any sense. So. I don't know. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. When is this film coming out?
Just says coming soon so far.
Do you think maybe they like Sonic the Hedgehog this? And they just go back and like CGI some fucking mime makeup on old Skarsgård?
I don't think they're going to do
honestly,
that.
Honestly, you know what? If the makeup means so much. Like if they did that, you know, you might have sold yourself a ticket here. So... You know,
maybe they Marvel project it and he puts on the paint at the end. You know, it's like right before the big battle. That's a
big mistake not to show that in your trailer.
Oh, in your trailer, right? Yeah.
And now for the nerd's review of Late Night with the Devil.
And now, our feature presentation.
Our viewer.
You're meddling with things you don't understand.
Whoa! Now, as you know, here on Night Owls, we think it's very important to keep an open mind. Please welcome Dr. June Ross Mitchell and Lily, the young subject of the book, Conversations with the Devil.
I really don't think it's a good idea, Jack. She's becoming more unpredictable.
That's a good thing. That's why we still do what? TV.
Ladies and gentlemen, please stay tuned for a live television first as we attempt to commune with the devil.
A live television broadcast in 1977 goes horribly wrong, unleashing evil into the nation's living rooms. This was written and directed by the brothers Cameron Karnes and Colin Karnes.
So Late Night with the Devil is a fun, clever take on the occult movie, a genre of film that, when done right, is one of my favorites. But truly great movies in this category tend to be few and far in between because they make the mistake of trying to emulate The Exorcist or Rosemary's Baby instead of telling their own story. But that's not the case with Late Night with the Devil. I mean, the film does take those familiar themes, but it delivers it through the lens of a 70s late night talk show, instantly breathing new life into the formula we've seen countless times, and really giving horror fans something unique and special. So struggling late night host Jack Del Roy, played by David Desmulchin, has turned to the spectacle of the macabre when he features a guest who supposedly is possessed by a demon, all in the hopes of spiking a rating during sweeps on Halloween night. So Late Night opens with a documentary style intro, which hit all the right nostalgic buttons for a kid who grew up around this era. We witness the rest of the movie, though, take place on Jack's late night show set, either while the cameras are rolling or behind the scenes during commercial breaks. Everything plays out in real time, which drives the tension and gives the film a pacing that's slow burn yet electric, because we're dealing with the frenetic energy of a live TV show. This choice allows things to build to a fever pitch and a surreal, memorable climax that I would argue is as dark and twisted as it is strangely beautiful. The film is anchored by DeSmelchin, who does a wonderful job of making Jack likable, but obviously tortured by his own ambition. How far will Jack be willing to go to save his career in a show? And is the price of fame worth his soul? You can really feel the darkness below the surface slowly unveiling itself throughout DeSmelchin's performance as he desperately tries to hold things together. Now, the 70s aesthetic is just the perfect choice by the director slash writers for the overall vibe of the film. It just lends itself to the ambiance, but also adds a charm to things. I mean, this isn't a big budget film by any means, but making this a period piece just added to the authenticity and made the movie feel like it was actually shot in that era in a way. And I think there's something about that era of TV that there's just a little more grit to it, which just makes everything feel a little more real, at least to me. But you take all these ingredients and you add them up, and what you have is the making of an instant cult classic. Late Night with the Devil is the kind of original horror film that makes the genre great. You know, it's the kind of movie that feels dangerous because, you know, horror knows no boundaries, and it just makes the creative possibilities limitless. And that's exactly the kind of movie that directors Colin and Cameron Cairns has crafted here, along with the help of a really strong cast. So I'm going to go ahead and give Late Night with the Devil an A. Horror fans, make sure you head to the theaters this weekend and support this film and spread the word. Late Night with the Devil is the kind of film horror needs more of, but it's up to you to demand it. The film is currently playing at a theater near you and will be streaming on Shudder sometime in late April.
And now it's time for Christian's Corner.
So this week marked the launch of the Star Wars Battlefront collection, and while I had some unexpected bills which came up and stopped me from buying this game right off on day one, I did tune in to see how others were reacting to it, and boy were they negative. It seems Aspyr had some network issues at launch and only had 3 servers available to join, only allowing about 10k players in each server. This would lead to mass frustration for those who just bought the game to play online with their friends. Later, the server cap was lifted and more servers were added, but many were still left unsatisfied as they ran into a lot of game-breaking glitches, like not being able to spawn as a villain in the game, and a whole lot more. So it's been a bit of a rough launch for this beloved title. And it coming in at $35, many are wondering if it's even worth having. A lot of refunds are going out right now on Steam, for sure. It was a staple for me growing up. It was one of my favorite games, so I'm a little disappointed to see this launch be like this. I think I still want to buy it just because I want the ability to play this game online, and I'm hoping that Aspyr is able to fix a lot of these issues. But I can see why a lot of people would be frustrated with this not being like a $20 title instead, as it does look like a straight port of the original game. Also, looking at 65 gigs on your hard drive, which is something that I feel like is just kind of standard nowadays, but I see a lot of people complaining about it too, where it's just like all these games are coming out way larger than they used to. And when you're looking at a game with like PS2 graphics, you're wondering like, why is this 65 gigs? Like, why are these textures are not worth this size of a game? But I don't think any game is really coming out as compressed as they used to. Yeah, this is one that I want to play and stream with you guys, and play with Victor on, you know, Twitch. So we're gonna see what happens. I might just buy it this weekend anyway and just fucking, you know, get on. But yeah, it's definitely been a rough launch for this, and I'm hoping for better from Aspyre. But, you know, speaking of them, there's another title that they have their hands in, and that's the Knights of the Old Republic game that seemed kind of dead in the water for a while there. However, Saber Interactive, who is also working on the game, is, you know, leaving Embracer Group, and it seems that the game may be back in the works. But it's kind of a messy deal because, you know, Saber is no longer a part of Embracer, but in the deal that they made, Embracer will still have partial ownership over the Knights of the Old Republic game. You know, remake. Obviously, Embracer knows that anything Star Wars is going to make them money, so I understand why they wouldn't want to give up on this title right away. But Aspyre, Saber, and Embracer all working together does sound a bit messy to me. I just hope that, you know, they're all able to work solidly and this game does get made. It was alluded to the game not coming out for quite a while, so I wouldn't be surprised if we've got another 3 to 5 years to go before we see, you know, the Knights of the Old Republic finally get remade and, you know, get the treatment that it deserves. It definitely deserves a proper remake, though. I hope we don't get, like, just another garbage port. But outside of Star Wars, we had another big interesting story drop this week, and that was dealing with kind of these Sony and Insomniac leaks as a concept trailer for a multiplayer Spider-Man game called Spider-Man the Great Web, which would see you able to play with four of your friends in a multiverse-like storyline, where, you know, you could play as like Spider-Gwen and more. This led to a ton of uproar online about this being canceled, as even Spider-Man 2 kind of hinted towards a Spider-Verse, you know, style game to come out of this. But personally, I think, and this might just be me, but I feel like the, you know, mission structure going forward for a game like that would be kind of boring. Like, when I try to think of what missions, you know, they would even make for this, it just all seems like I would be doing, you know, the same fight over and over again, and probably lead to like a mini boss fight, and maybe a bigger one down the line. Like, I just don't imagine it being as fun as a lot of people are saying that it would probably be. Like, I just don't feel like the Spider-Man games lends itself to a live service multiplayer experience. Like, that's not to say that Insomniac couldn't make something, you know, cool. I do trust them in making some awesome gameplay. I do think there's a limit to what you can do with a live service experience that would make this, you know, just not as interesting as the actual games. Like, there could be a great story attached, but I don't know. I just feel like it's gonna end up being another Suicide Squad, and that's not what we want right now. You know, no statements have been made by Insomniac or Sony at this time, and it's always tough to see, you know, big projects get leaked like this. You know, you never know, they could have been thinking about doing something different in the future, and that's why this version got canceled. So, you know, if that's something that you really want, though, make sure that you're like shouting it out online and, you know, letting the companies know that this is something that would work for them. But really, I feel like you get only one good, you know, live service game a year. And right now that seems to be Helldivers, so I don't expect anything else worthwhile coming out. But if you think you saw the trailer, let us know on social media what you thought at Amazing Nerd Show or at Amazing Nerd Live, as I would love to know if you were really, you know, hoping for something like this to come out. But again, not every story needs to be, you know, a multiplayer game. Not everything needs to be a live service game. And I'm happy that companies like Sony are, you know, open to the fact that live service games aren't working the way that, you know, a lot of these people think that they would, like how Warner is all in on fucking live service games, and it's clearly not going to work out for them. But, you know, Warner doesn't know how to make good business decisions, it seems. Anyway, with all that said, let's go ahead and move on to some wrestling.
So let's get down to business, huh? You want to know why I'm here? Because I need to be here. I want to be here. AEW is the only place where this revolution can be global. And we are going to make that happen.
All right, Christian, so this week we don't have tons of time for wrestling, but we definitely wanted to talk Mercedes Moné's big debut in AEW on this past week's Dynamite, which was labeled what? Big business? I always want to say big,
yes,
money.
Big business.
Big business. What were your overall thoughts on her AEW debut?
One, I'm glad that they changed the theme. I'm still not in love with this one either.
No, I was going to say.
I Like, I get the whole, like, them trying to do the CEO chant and get all that going, but I don't know. It doesn't feel great. It's still a little bit better than the New Japan version, but...
It just feels so forced. And I won't lie, yeah. Like, the New Japan version started to grow on me, but I guess it samples a Crisscross song from back in the 90s, okay. So that's probably, you know, licensing-wise, why they didn't want to use that. I don't know. Like, I like the CEO chant, and I loved how, like, much Boston was into, like, actually doing the chant. But I just wish it was a little more organic. You know, like,
yeah. I just don't know if it's going to land across the country other than, you know, her hometown.
I agree. But I guess we'll have to wait and see. I mean, the song's not awful, like, once you get past the chant. But it just felt a little cheesy to have that, like, up front. I thought, like, her on the microphone was great. The presentation worked well. You know, she's not known for her mic work, but I thought she did a solid enough job laying out her mission statement. You know, I wish she would have put AEW over a little more. It felt like it was more about, like, you know, me. But she has done that, you know, after the fact in other interviews.
But either way, even I know that, you know, she's starting off as a face, but I'm ready for heel. Like, she just works so much better as a heel character.
She does.
Every single time.
She does. Like, the all the pomp and circumstance, the, you know, unbridled arrogance. I'm sure that, you know, her time will come as a heel in the company. But I understand why they didn't want to start her off that way.
Yeah.
Although part of me was like, man, she would be a great fit with the new version of the Elite. I could see her being a big part of that faction.
That does work very well. I could have seen
that. Yeah, right. And I mean, who knows? Maybe eventually that does happen. So, I mean, she does have a little bit of a history with Okada. They did share the ring and they did talk about tagging, you know, when she showed up in New Japan. So maybe that's still on the board. Who knows? Also, I do think it was a mistake that they didn't do more of a tease that, you know, she'd be sticking around for the main event. I know she briefly mentioned it, but I think it would have been better if, you know, she actually said, you know, I'm going to be sticking around to, you know, check out the match or something, you know? Because, I mean, if you look at the ratings, it dipped big time in that last quarter. So that's unfortunate, and we'll talk about it in a little bit. But I thought the match between Rio and Willow was pretty fantastic.
I mean, they tried to do, like, that one commercial break spot where, you know, Mercedes, you know, walks up to Riho and says, like, I can't wait to see your match later. But that's about it.
Yeah.
I mean, that was randomly throughout the episode.
And that was, like, later on in the episode.
Yes, way later.
So, you know, maybe, you know, in another, like, segment or two, that's when you have that happen. But anyway, overall, I think this is a huge signing for AEW and could possibly be a game changer for the women's division. But I'm going to reserve any judgment and wait to see how, you know, all this plays out, because I believe we've said that about, you know, many women's signings, and it just hasn't worked out, unfortunately, that way.
Nah, but now that you've mentioned her being a part of the Elite, it's all I'm thinking about. It's like they could have easily made, like, you know, plays against, you know, how people perceive the AEW women's division and how, like, she's, you know, working with Nicholas and Matt. They can just, you know, make it better. There's so many angles
and
there.
I think it would instantly make her a big deal in AEW fans' eyes. I mean, she's already a big deal, don't get me wrong, but, like, it would show you that she is going to be a main event feature, you know, from now on. She's not going to be someone who, you know, shows up, gets a title shot, and then in the shuffle, because it would mean that she's in, like, the featured, you know, biggest storyline in the company going. So,
yeah.
I don't know. And that could all still play out. Who knows? You know, it's just wild speculation on my part, but it feels like it makes way too much sense also.
So Tony, while you're listening to this, you can take this idea.
Sure. I'm sure he's listening. He's not busy at all, Christian. Anyway, moving on. What do we have next after this?
Well, we had some backstage promos from Adam Cole reading from a book about, you know, Wardlow, which all led to Samoa Joe going up against Wardlow for the title.
Yeah, I mean, the Adam Cole shit was kind of cheesy, but I like the effort, if that makes any sense. I like the fact that they're promoting the match on the show, you know, hyping it up, because that's something that AEW once in a while forgets to do. But you know, when I saw this segment, I was like, oh my gosh, is Wardlow going to go over here? And that wasn't the case at all. Like, no. This was a pretty, like, color by numbers, you know, world title match. You know, the second segment of the show, it just felt like something they were trying to get out of the way. I was not expecting that at all from, you know, a Wardlow title shot.
Especially for a match dealing with a guy who's now part of a massive, like, important faction in your company. You would think that they would... you would think that they were going to be a part of the match in some form or fashion.
Yes. Either way. Now I'm wondering if the story going forward is Wardlow failing and maybe that's going to cause a rift in the group. Like, he's now on the outs with the Undisputed Kingdom, which I would totally be fine with. Like, I was half expecting, and I think I talked about this last week, MJF, like, showing up and costing Wardlow the match. Because that way, at least Wardlow stays hot. But I will say, like, this put over Joe big time. You know, the fact that he was able to, like, vanquish Wardlow in, what, like, a 10, 12-minute match, maybe? And it was a clean win. After the match, we had Swerve Strickland come out with a chain wrapped around his fist. He took out some security guards. Samoa Joe just chose to exit the ring instead of facing him. And I thought it did a really good job of, like, heating things up between Swerve and Joe. I love Joe taunting Swerve, you know, doing the go to sleep motion to him because he choked him out last week. And then I also love Joe fucking kicking that security guard off the ramp who was laying unconscious. That was pretty fucking awesome. Joe's having quite the run, and it's disappointing that, you know, it's probably going to come to the end next pay-per-view, because I'm definitely predicting that Swerve's going to, you know, win that title there.
It would be a disservice if they didn't. But at the same time, I'm just like, I love everything going on for Swerve. That's great. But this does nothing for Wardlow.
No, but honestly, Christian,
I know we don't, like,
do you really give a shit about Wardlow this much to even care?
No, but I care, like, in the fact that, like, we built up a storyline to Wardlow again, just having the same type of end like he does in every fucking title match.
You know, they shot themselves in the foot and they lost the moment. And it sucks. And it sucks for Wardlow. He probably deserves better. But at the same time, it is what it is. I'm not invested in the character whatsoever. And I'm kind of glad that it's out of the way now, honestly. Like, they could have done it in a way to keep him hot. But I think at this point, the writing's on the wall. And maybe Tony doesn't necessarily see Wardlow ready for the main event scene, which is fine.
After this, we had Alex Marvez doing an interview with the Young Bucks and Okada, asking why Okada joined the Elite.
The best part of this was Okada making Alex sing happy birthday to the Bucks. I thought that was pretty awesome. But yeah, I'm loving the chemistry between Okada and the Elite. He feels like the perfect fit. Corporate Bucks might be my favorite version of the Bucks in AEW's short lifespan. They're just hitting on all cylinders right now, honestly. And I can't wait to see, you know, what they have in store for us in the future. So, cause there's just so many different angles that can spin out of this faction, really.
And we did get to see them in action right after this, as they defeated Pac, Eddie Kingston, and Penta.
And surprisingly enough, it looks like we're going to be getting Eddie Kingston versus Okada next week for the Continental title. They made sure to mention that it's for the Continental title, not the Continental crown. So I'm guessing only that belt is on the line, which leads me to believe, and I would have believed this anyway, that Okada's probably picking up the win here. So, I'm glad Pac is back. This past weekend on Collision, the Elite were in action also, and just an amazing piece of business with Okada single-handedly taking out a trio's group of jobbers by himself, while the Bucks just, like, kind of sat on the apron laughing. And that's where, you know, this whole match got kind of set up. You know, Kingston came out, followed by Penta, and then followed by the returning Pac. Hopefully Pac can stay healthy, because, you know, obviously the main event scene is better for having him in it.
All right. Well, after this, we had Will Ospreay addressing Bryan Danielson, and, you know, letting us know what he's bringing to AEW.
How fucking over is Ospreay?
Oh, so over.
And he deserves it. Holy shit.
100%.
Like, and the crowd's really taken to the whole Bruv thing, huh?
Uh-huh.
That's fucking huge, man. If you got, like, a one-liner or something that, you know, the crowd can say with you, mm-hmm. like, that's a different level of over. Yeah, I mean, we know he has it, like, in ring-wise, but now that he's getting his personality and character over, I mean, he's going to be, like, the top babyface in no time if he's not already in the company. And I cannot fucking wait to see Ospreay versus Bryan. That should be an instant match of the year candidate. So, and that's actually taking place on Dynasty, right?
Exactly. I mean, that should sell the pay-per-view itself.
Oh, easily. But, that's it. I mean, they could sell tons of tickets just on that match alone. So, because I really was expecting Okada and Kingston to be on that match or
on that card,
on that card. But apparently that's not the case. But I guess we could see a rematch maybe take place there. So
I guess I was almost hoping that would be Pac versus Okada on Dynasty.
That could also happen. Mm-hmm. So who knows? Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, Dynasty is really shaping up to be one hell of a card. So
after this, we saw what could be potentially Darby Allin's final match as he went up against Switchblade Jay White.
Yes. And we have the return of the Jay White everyone wants to see in AEW. I thought this was a really well worked match psychology wise. I love Darby coming out looking like the Invisible Man, of course. I love that he was just completely bandaged, you know, like his entire like upper torso. And you know, that's how they worked the match. You know, White really focused on his back, and rightfully so. Every single bump looked excruciating. You know, Darby is so great at just selling, and you know, forget about all the Daredevil stuff. I mean, don't, but I mean, I think selling is one of the big reasons why he's so over, you know, at this point in his career. But yeah, I mean, Jay White's a bastard, and I want to see more of this version of the character. I'm glad that we're done with the whole fucking bang bang scissor gang. After the match, you know, it looked like Jay was going to shake Darby's hand. The Bullet Club Gold jumped Darby instead. Out came the Acclaim trying to talk some sense into the Bullet Club. Billy Gunn was getting in Jay White's face. As the Acclaim was out of the ring, the Bullet Club took out Billy. And then, you know, once the Acclaim got back in the ring, they took out them too. So, I mean, I don't think anyone was enjoying this faction, and it felt like it was just, you know, for the short term right off the bat. Like, it just felt like something for Jay White to do in the meantime until, you know, they could refocus on him as a character. And now that we have wrestlers like Ospreay and Okada, I mean, he's the perfect foil for both of those guys to go up against. Like, yes, he should be one of your main event echelon heels. So hopefully they're able to, like, recalibrate him and get back to where he should be. Because once again, like, it was just refreshing to see this version of that character. You know, like, I enjoy all the comedy and shit like that that we're getting with the Bullet Club Gold. And I'm sure we'll still get some of that, especially once Juice comes back. But like, this is the version of Jay White that Tony signed in the first place, you know, not, you know, the version walking down with props and shit like that, and, you know, cardboard cutouts of himself or Juice. So, I mean, do what you can to get yourself over, but now's the time to move on and get serious.
Do you still think that they want to unify all the 6-man titles to make it just one?
I'm guessing that's what the pay-per-view match is going to be.
Okay.
And if that was the goal in the first place of this program, then so be it. It just took way too long to get here. And I have a feeling that the only reason why it ended here is because they heard the fans bitching and complaining about it. But, I mean, thankfully, they actually listened to their audience. So, I mean, most of the time.
Do you know what the audience really wanted?
Was it
Lion Hook?
Nope.
Defeating the Gates of Agony.
No one wants this. No one wants this. Jericho needs to go away. I mean, the crowd turned on him right after this match when he had his little interview segment.
Yeah.
They worked fine as a team together, but I'm guessing, you know, next week Jericho challenged Hook to a match. I'm guessing Jericho's going to turn on him. But no one needs this program. And unfortunately right now for where Jericho is in his career, it honestly feels kind of like a step down for Hook. I don't know, man. Like, Jericho needs, and I said this last week, Jericho needs to go away for about 6 months and come back and, you know, get that pop and get back into the groove and just kind of like recalibrate what his character means to the company going forward. It just kind of feels like he's trying to have his cake and eat it too. You know, if that makes any sense. Like, I feel like, you know, he wants to be the guy putting over the young talent and working with the young talent, but at the same time, like, he still wants like 2 to 3 segments every show. And be considered like one of the main event guys. And that unfortunately is not the case anymore. Allow the fans to miss you a little. And it's funny that this is Jericho who's like overstaying his welcome right now, because he's the king of reading the room and knowing when is enough. And I don't know, that hasn't been the case. I mean, we had the controversy that, you know, took place on the internet. And I guess he probably, like, optics wise, didn't want to step away right away. That's what I was assuming it was. But like, now that the crowd is warmed up to you again, I think it's a good time to step away, to like, you know, freshen up your character and, you know, allow people to miss you and, you know, love you again.
I mean, I doubt he'd do this, but I wouldn't mind if he like stepped away and came back with like almost the same Y2J character that he did back in the 2000s. You know, like I wouldn't mind that heel version of him. Like as a like starter heel for like, you know, some of the newer characters in the company, that would be perfect.
Almost like a gatekeeper type character. I could see that. I don't know. I mean, he won't be able to be like a carbon copy of that character, and he's never wanted to do things like that. But like a new version of that character, 2024 version of that character, I think that would work. But he definitely just needs to step away. Leave us alone. Like, the Jericho Vortex is a real fucking thing. And we're losing Hook to it as we speak.
Well, this all came to a close with Willow Nightingale defeating Riho in the main event.
I thought this was a really fun match. I think my only issue with it, and this is kind of with Riho overall, is sometimes she just, I don't know, does too much. She becomes like Hulk Hogan in WrestleMania 3. And like, I mean, even Hogan struggled to slam Andre. But like, she's up here fucking doing like dragon suplexes to fucking Willow Nightingale, who's like 4 times her size. So I have a hard time like suspending my, you know, disbelief. Like, I don't know. Like, there's other ways to chop a giant down. But like the match itself, like she always finds a way to get over. And the same with Willow. It definitely wasn't a one-sided affair, but I don't know. I really enjoyed this match. You know, afterwards we had Julia Hart and Sky Blue show up, you know, attempting to jump Willow, and Mercedes, costume change and all, made the save. You know, she afterwards begrudgingly held up Willow's hand. It sounds like that's probably going to be a program at some point, since her last match was against Willow in a match where she suffered an injury and a loss. So, there's some unfinished business there. But like perhaps her and Julia Hart will be facing off, you know, sooner than later. So after Dynamite went off the air, they did a little video package, not video package, but they did a little video explaining where Stokely and Statlander were. Jumped from behind. I'm calling bullshit. I'm guessing this is like the start of Statlander's heel turn. You know, maybe she didn't want to make the save. And, you know, I could definitely see Statlander and Willow going into some sort of program. Moving forward, you know, perhaps after, you know, Mercedes and Willow have their match, or maybe like a tag match, you know, in the future with, you know, Willow tagging with Mercedes versus like Statlander and, you know, name your wrestler, right? I don't think Statlander's going to join like Julia Hart or anything, but it definitely feels like Stokely's pulling some strings here with Statlander and is like finally like won her over.
Perhaps this is all just a setup from Mercedes. You know, it's to make her look good, and she's using Stokely and Statlander.
Maybe in a couple months I could agree with you, but I think it's probably too soon for something that maniacal from her. Like, I don't foresee a heel turn, at least for, you know, 3 or 4 months. from her. So I could be wrong. But yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it for Dynamite. I don't know, man. The product feels hot right now. I know the ratings aren't necessarily reflecting it, but I mean, you look at the fucking string of free agent signings that they just had. Fucking Okada, Ospreay, Mercedes. I mean, man, I mean, Tony pretty much has a dream roster at his disposal right now. You know, those three signings alone, I feel like just revitalizes all of your shows. So, I don't know, everything just feels like it's clicking right now. And they're just headed in the right direction. So, hopefully the wheels don't come off anytime soon. Cause we've seen that happen in the past. You know, injuries are a bitch and they happen, unfortunately. You know, this is in ballet. So, hopefully everyone can stay healthy. That always seems to be AEW's undoing when it comes to like momentum. It's just a ugly string of, you know, injuries always like right around the corner. So, but I mean, you look at it right now, like you've got people like MJF, Adam Cole, and Kenny Omega on the shelf. And honestly, they don't feel like they're missed, which is crazy to say, because obviously the product would be better with, you know, all three wrestlers, you know, being part of it. But I mean, their roster is so strong that, you know, they're not hurt by like some seriously major injuries, you know, to your main event scene. A couple years ago, that'd be a fucking death knell. So it's crazy.
The roster is strong enough right now that I feel like there's no excuse not to make Collision a hotter show. That makes me want to tune in each week. Now, I know it's still in a bad time slot, but
I agree.
I will say
Collision this past week felt must see, like storylines actually progressed, so hopefully they continue that momentum, because I agree Collision at this point is a show that I watch on Mondays, maybe, you know, if I get around to it. So it's an absolute like DVR watch. It's been quite a while since like I've been glued to my TV on a Saturday night watching Collision. So it'd be great, like you said, to get that excitement up for that show. And I agree, like 100%, like there's no excuse for it not being that way. And I understand, like, you want to keep Dynamite your number one show. And that seems to be Tony's priority, because no matter what, there's a ceiling on Collision because of that time slot. And they're never going to get past that. But that doesn't mean it needs to be a glorified version of, you know, the old Sunday Night Heat show. And there's been a lot of episodes where it absolutely feels that way. I don't know. I mean, you're right. I mean, way to take away Tony's flowers and stomp on them and, you know, piss all over them after I've tried to end the show on a positive note, Christian, but you know, it is what it is.
It's my job. All right. Bring everything back down to reality.
But anyway, regardless of how Collision's being booked, I still feel like the future's pretty fucking bright in 2024 for AEW. Well, that does it for this week.
As a friendly reminder, make sure to follow us on your favorite podcast platform, and while you're there, leave a 5-star review.
It really helps new listeners to find the podcast and for us to continue to grow.
Also, if you like the stories from this week's episode and want to keep up to date with the show, follow us on social media at Amazing Nerd Show or stop by theamazingnerdshow.com.
And hey, to support the show further and get additional weekly content, you can subscribe to us now on Patreon. Just follow the link in the show notes.
Also, if you want to rep some Nerd Show swag, you can head over to tpublic.com to find t-shirts, hoodies, stickers, and more.
And if you post what you bought and tag us on social media, we'll send you some additional Nerd Show swag as long as you live in the United States. All right, make sure to join us next week as we talk all the latest news and rumors in nerd culture.
And whatever's going on in the world of wrestling. My name's Christian.
And my name's David.
And that was The Amazing Nerd Show.
Nice outfit. Not sure about the face, though.